This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Michael Ondaatje's best-selling novel, The English Patient, is now a film. It stars Ralph Fiennes, Kristin Scott Thomas, Juliette Binoche, and Willem Dafoe, and opens next week in New York and Los Angeles. My guest, Anthony Minghella, wrote and directed the movie. The story intercuts between two love affairs, during and before World War II, in an abandoned villa in Italy and in the deserts of North Africa. Fiennes plays the English patient, a man burned beyond recognition when his plane crashes in the desert. In flashbacks, we learn about his life as an explorer in the Sahara and his love affair with Catherine, his colleague's wife, played by Scott Thomas. In this scene, they're trying to watch a movie, but their thoughts are elsewhere.
I better go now. Say goodbye here.
I'm not agreeing. Don't think I'm agreeing, because I'm not.
Any minute now, he'll find out. We'll barge into someone. It will kill him.
Don't go over it again, please. Catherine. I just want you to know I'm not missing you yet.
You will. You will.
The other lovers in the film are Hannah, an army nurse, who's caring for the English patient at the end of the war, and Kip, an Indian soldier in the British Army. Minghella collaborated on the screenplay with the book's author, Michael Ondaatje, and his producer, Saul Zantz, but I asked him if he still wasn't just a little bit afraid that his film would fall short of the novel.
Well, I think that you know, of course I felt an enormous trepidation, because what's distinctive about this project is that I love Michael Ondaatje's writing. I'd read everything he'd ever written. Reading The English Patient was supposed to be a treat, not an invitation to do a job. And if nothing else, and if no one else, I wanted one person to be happy with this film, and that was Michael himself. So obviously, I approached the whole project with some caution. He can write Crown, and what you do as a reader is you fashion a king, you know, and or he can write Castle, and you fashion a kingdom. Whereas one of the things which is, you know, disappointing, I suppose, about filmmaking is it's incredibly prosaic, and certainly in its first stages, is that there's an obligation to fill the camera with something. You can't just simply, if you point a camera at a crown, you see a crown and nothing else. And so in a book which does have such enormous ambitions in terms of the countries and times that it traverses, one of the things I had to do as the adapter of the book was to go and teach myself the history and geography that the book maps. And so I found myself, you know, submerged in the literature of the 30s, in the memorabilia and memoirs of the 30s, and letters and diaries and cuttings. And so what happened was, when I came to go back to the novel, I came armed with so much of my own compulsions about the time and the place and the circumstances of Cairo or of Italy at the end of the war, that I found myself with a huge deluge of material to bring to bear, because I had to fill in rather than do this you know, suggestive art that Michael can indulge in.
Well, you shut yourself up in a cottage in Dorset in mm-hmm. England with all of these books of history and geography, but you say you didn't take the actual novel, The English Patient, with you. Why not?
Well, it's probably evident from what I've said so far that this is a novel that meant a great deal to me, that spoke to me, I think, there for all kinds of reasons. You know, that there are certain intrinsic kindred relationships between Michael and I which speak in this book. And I suppose that, you know, frankly, what I was nervous of was that if I took the book with me, I'd sit all day copying out chunks of it into the screenplay. And the one thing, of course, that I think would have been a terrible error in this movie would have been to have made some kind of literary artifice which knelt down and paid homage to the book, which didn't exist in its own right as a film.
You know, film really isn't very good at subtleties, but this is a film full of subtleties. For instance, The English Patient can barely move. Ralph Fiennes has so much makeup on his face as a burn victim that mm-hmm. his movements are so spare, and everyone tells.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, what we did, poor Rafe, you know, we had a body cast. It's not makeup. He had a body cast made by the Jim Henson Creature Shop, and they literally made him a skin. and he had a skin for every day that he was the English patient at Cinecittà in Rome, and he had to be, you know, fitted inside this skin every morning, and it was an extraordinary thing. He disappeared, in a way, into that skin and disappeared, became somebody else, and well, the only thing he had available to him really was his voice and his eyes, and even his eyes, which are, you know, notoriously piercing and haunting, they were obscured by very dark contact lenses and very blurred contact lenses, and so he made it as hard as it could possibly be, or I made it as hard as it possibly could be, for you to understand or relate to him. And yet, nevertheless, what it does is it simplifies the instrument, as it were, so much that every note becomes extremely significant and sharp.
There's really a lovely scene in the movie between the pair of lovers, Hannah, the nurse, mm-hmm. and Kip, the Sikh disposal, bomb disposal expert. Kip arranges a surprise for Hannah. He takes her to a chapel. It's dark. He hoists her up on a pulley and puts a burning flare in her hand, and she swings up and down as the flare illuminates beautiful frescoes on the walls of the chapel. And it has such a gentle, romantic tone, and that tone comes up so much throughout a movie that's about shell-shocked people in war, about death, about loss.
Well, you know, here's what I thought, which was that I wanted to make an extremely erotic film. It seemed to me that given that the central notion to me in the book, or the line that most resonated with me, was that the heart is an organ of fire. And I thought, then I wanted to in a way, characterize an incandescent, slightly catastrophic, raging love story in which people, in a sense, become perhaps less civilized, but certainly more human. They rage at the love that they feel. And I'm talking about now Catherine Clifton and Amishi, the other couple in the film. And that, because of that, because I wanted that to be a no-holds-barred physical relationship, it seemed to me that given that there was another very important love story in the film, that had to have its own music and its own particular characteristics. And I thought, well, how could I make a love scene in a film in which people didn't even touch each other? How could I do something in which the lovemaking was done in the form of some gift? And so here's an example, really, of the blessing, I suppose, of not having the book too close to me when I was writing, was that there was a moment of Kip in the novel taking an old university professor to look at some frescoes. And I was so touched by that in the book, but obviously, as I talked about earlier, I was trying to find some dramatic correlative of those ideas in the novel. And thinking of that and remembering that gave me the opportunity to give Kip and Hannah their love scene in this, I suppose, quite distinctive and very tender fashion, because I wanted the tenderness of love and the healing issues of love to be running in the film alongside, as you said, the more coruscating landscapes of the film.
You filmed many of the scenes in the deserts of the Sahara, mm-hmm. and in Tunisia. And I would imagine filming in the desert poses some practical problems. I mean, I can't imagine the cameras go very well with blowing sand. What unforeseen difficulties did you encounter filming on location?
Well, I think the first thing, you know, I said earlier that stupidity has informed almost every junction of this job for me. And I think that when I went to scout the desert, I was so, as many people before me, so overwhelmed by its clarity and by its sort of spiritual nourishing and simplicity, that I quite overlooked what was going to be involved when I had a film camera there and a film crew and 150 people needing to do their work. And the first thing I want to say about it is that the desert, filming in the desert, is like filming in snow. It's completely unforgiving, just in a very prosaic sense, which is that you can't walk over a dune and then try and photograph it, because you leave your footprints behind. And so we had this gymnastic stricture of how to get to the places we wanted to shoot without leaving our footprints, how to get the cameras to places which didn't have roads. The sensation I had was of being a calligrapher in many ways. I had a brush loaded with paint and a virgin sheet of paper, and the minute that I made a mark, that was it. It was irreducible and unerasable, and I had to stay with it and commit myself. And that put such pressure on me that I'm afraid that whereas when I went initially I thought the desert was the most beautiful place in the world. I ended up thinking it was the most unforgiving, and it was my enemy, and I was its enemy, and it was extremely difficult for me. And I made matters as bad as I could by breaking my ankle about 2 weeks before we got there.
And you didn't even take an afternoon off, apparently.
Well, you know, like Count Dolmashi in the film, Ralph Fiennes' character, who is compulsive and obsessed, and I found myself compulsive and obsessed about making this film. I felt as though somehow everything was depending on my pulling this film off, that it was me, that I lost all sense of, I think, a perspective when I was doing it. I became this maniac for finishing this film and coming out of my own desert and finishing it.
Anthony Minghella is my guest. He's the screenwriter and director of the new film, The English Patient, based on the Michael Ondaatje novel. We're going to take a short break now, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Anthony Minghella. He wrote the screenplay and directed the new film, The English Patient. Your parents are from Italy, and apparently in the course of your research for The English Patient, you happened on some information about a tragedy that occurred in your father's hometown during the war. You hadn't heard the story from your father?
Well, it wasn't so much that I didn't know about the fact that the monastery in Monte Cassino was razed to the ground by the Allies. It was that I didn't know the circumstances. And I think that one of the things that struck me when I was doing the research was that I was probably in many ways trying to find my way back to Italy, which is my parents' home. And I found out all kinds of things. You know, I found out that how long the war was becalmed in Monte Cassino, how many people died, and what varying nationalities of people died. There were Brazilian deaths, there were Polish deaths, there were Indian deaths. You know, I think one of the things that happens is that there's a certain simplification of our understanding of history. And one of the things that happens when you do the research is you realize that wars are chaotic and don't fall into easy and comfortable patterns. And I also discovered that a member of my family was involved in leading a partisan movement in Tuscany, which I hadn't known about before. In fact, my father didn't know about. So there were many discoveries I made, and not least I managed to get back to Italy to make a film. And it's obviously, in terms of my own sensibility as a maker of fiction, as a director, Italy is my home in every sense.
How did your parents end up in England?
My mother spent all her life in England. Her parents had come from a tiny village near to where my father comes from. My father came to England because he was a shepherd in Italy, and it was of very humble stock, and a paisan, we say. One of the, I think, the very familiar features of all issues of emigration has been that when people come to another country and are successful, they tend to bring poor relations and friends with them to be drudges in a way. And I think that what happened with my father was that somebody sent him a railway ticket to bring him to England so that he could work for an ice cream company. And in fact, he did that, started that 50 years ago, and he's still an ice cream man today. It's interesting you should mention that, because one of the things that's happened to me, I realize, is that when I was in Rome and Cinecittà and so excited to be shooting there and in Fellini's footsteps, I was reading Fellini's biography, and in his biography he was talking about his own father, who was a seller of prosciutto and salami and olive oil, and he was saying that, you know, when he was a kid his dad would be talking about this stuff, and he was privately vowing to himself he would never ever sell anything himself, and then he found himself in his adult life sitting in front of Hollywood producers selling them his particular brand of prosciutto and salami. And my dad, you know, encouraged me, I use that word advisedly, to drive an ice cream van for him when I was a kid and sell ice cream. And I would always vow to myself that no point in my life would I ever sell anybody anything. And then, of course, now I find myself with my particular brand of ice cream to sell here.
Now, you also grew up on the Isle of Wight, and mm-hmm. I don't know much about the Isle of Wight. I think of it as a desolate place. Is that what it's like?
No, it's not desolate at all. But I must tell you that it's funny, because Michael and Saul plagued me because I was determined to get as many references to the island as I could into the film. And it's a great irony, and I think one that I celebrate, that irony in the film, is that it's a film that keeps saying, look, let's look at the way we make boundaries. Let's look at this artifice of nationality, this sort of strangely plaguing issue of patriotism. Look how stupid it is. Look how damaging it is. And at the same time, I keep colliding with the fact that I'm, in many ways, incredibly nationalistic, and I'm extremely nostalgic about the Isle of Wight. I want to keep colliding with it. I want to. If you said to me, "I come from the Isle of Wight," then you'd be my friend for life. And that's one of the ironies, I think, of the way that we are. The island itself is a very, very beautiful and very neglected place off the coast of southern coast of England. And I spent the first 18 years of my life there, and it was although it was a cultural backwater. I mean, that's what's desolate about it, is that there aren't too many books there. It's also an extraordinary place, a beautiful place, and I was very happy to spend time there.
I'd like to talk about your first film, Truly, Madly, Deeply. And that was a little bit of a sleeper, if I can say so, in the United States. And I think it was a real shame. I have to say, this movie, I can't describe it very well, but just briefly, it was about a woman whose lover had died, and she just can't let him go. She can't get over it. And then one day, her lover is there. He's there in their apartment where they live together, only he's from the world of the dead. He's a ghost, somewhat. And by the way, Alan Rickman is great at being dead in this movie. He comes back to their relationship, though, with a lot of annoying baggage as a result of being dead. Now, this is a comedy, and after I finished watching it, I thought, I don't really know what that was all about, but it was a lot of fun. How did other audiences respond to it? You must have gotten some strange responses.
Well, it's very interesting to me that 5 years after I made that film, I'm still getting letters, and I'm still encountering people who for whom that film meant something. And in fact, the British Association of Psychotherapy used the film now as bereavement counseling. And I think that what it was about for me was very simple. Maybe that was too simple, was that often you have to move on. And one of the ways that you move on from loss is to see what it really was. There's a certain amount of nostalgia that goes on about relationships which are over, not only people who've died, but things that we've given up or moved away from. And what the film said was, instead of dealing with that in an intellectual way, why don't I dramatize what it means to have the thing you most want come back to you, the thing you think you can't do without come back to you. And it's an allegorical film, obviously, because what Alan Rickman's character does in it is say, look at me for what I really was and not for what you wanted me to be, and in some ways exaggerate some of those more irritating and aggravating qualities in order to free her to move on. And you realize he's been a ghost with a mission in the film.
I don't want to read too much into your movie, so stop me here if this is an example of that. But looking at Truly, Madly, Deeply and The English Patient, there are so many parallels. They're both in some sense about loss. In the first case, in Truly, Madly, Deeply, the character gets back something that she lost, and it helps her, but it's not really what she wanted. Or I guess one of the messages is, beware of what you wish for. Mm-hmm. And The English Patient is loss on every possible level. I wonder how, after making two movies with such parallels, how you personally come out on the other side of that.
Well, first of all, I think these two films have in common is that the central characters are haunted in some way by what's happened to them. And they both are able to bring these ghosts somehow to life. For the ghost of Catherine Clifton, for The English Patient, is the ghost he has to exorcise in order, peculiarly, not to move on but to let go. He has to die, and in many ways, I think he's a man trapped in life until such time as he can work out the relationship that he had with somebody in the past. And I tried to make a film in which the past was in many ways more urgent than the present. Where I come out of all of this is that I suppose inevitably I want films which have an emotional register. I want to make stories in which people are encouraged to feel as much as they're encouraged to think. I think that's an underused muscle. I think there's a difference between feeling and reacting. I think that there's a type of movie which is being made at the moment which appears to be about emotion. It's in fact a sort of theme park ride. It throws you back in your seat and rocks you around. I think the emotion that asks you to make a contribution as a member of an audience, which takes an audience seriously, is something which those films are not being made so much anymore. And I suppose that when you talk about what the films are about, I'm an academic who loses all sense of his brain when he's working. I think, you know, I don't write from my head. I know I write from my heart and make films from my heart. And I suppose that it's no accident those two films which have been so important to me have been films in which there is a sort of intellectual structure, but essentially they're about trying to give people access to a full range of emotion.
And you personally, how does it resonate in your life?
Well, one of the virtues of being a dramatist is that you are forced into a position which takes you away from any overt investigation of your own pathology, I think. I mean, the nice thing is that you dramatize debate and you dramatize differences of opinion rather than simply shedding light on your own personality. And in many ways, I'm completely uninterested in myself and my own position. And one of the thrills about making drama is that it deals with argument and it deals with the moral complexity of position. I think what it says is that there are some fictions which seem to look at the world from a great height and tell you how the world works. The sort of fiction that I'm interested in says, look how complicated the world is. I don't understand it. I, Anthony Minghella, don't understand the way that we hurt each other, heal each other, support each other, lie to each other, are truthful to each other. I don't understand it. You can come and share that with me.
Anthony Minghella, I really enjoyed talking with you today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Anthony Minghella's film, The English Patient, opens next week in New York and Los Angeles, and in theaters around the country at the end of the month. This is Fresh Air.